So the topic for tonight is Paskening like the Meiri. And I want to talk about Paskening like the Meiri, both in the specific question, can one Paskin like the Meiri? What would be the implications of Paskin like the Meiri? But I want to put that in a broader context of the extent to which it's fair for ideology to drive Pesach. And there's a reason why one would want a Paskin like the Meiri. One doesn't particularly care about Paskin like the Meiri on Hilchos Shabbos and things like that. Right? That wouldn't be an issue that would bother anybody one way or the other. Right? The reason that one is interested in Paskin like the Meiri, the only time the question ever comes up, can I Paskin like the Meiri, is can I Paskin like the Meiri's unique positions about Jewish-Gentile relations? Right? That's really the only time the question comes up. The only reason anyone would care, right, is because the Meiri says unique things about that. The other positions of the Meiri are fundamentally irrelevant. So the first, right, and the reason why we want a Paskin like them is because one finds the Meiri's positions about Jewish-Gentile relationships more attractive than other positions. Right, in the draft of an article I'm trying to write about this, I think the fun paragraph I wrote was that the mere existence of Rabbi Nachman and Meiri has long been a source of great comfort to Orthodox Jews with universalist tendencies. Right, I think that, right, so the reason that one wants to Paskin like Meiri is because you have unique positions about Jewish-Gentile relations that appeal. Right, that appeal to those of us who have discomfort with laws that make sharp distinctions as to the obligations one has towards Gentiles as opposed to Jews, and particularly those laws that seem to imply that basic standards of ethics are limited within the Jewish community. So I want to start by addressing the question of, is it legitimate to find to have ideological motives for deciding how one wants to paskin? Then I move from that to briefly describe what I see as my own ideological motives in this issue, which I'm going to be explicit about, and then talk about what the Meiri actually means and whether in the end, A, I think it's okay to paskin like him, and B, whether I think it matters. So the question of whether it's legitimate to have ideological motives for Pesach. So to some degree, this is there's a famous idea recorded as a dispute in the Babylonian Talmud, which is whether we are Deresh Talmud Dikra, right? Whether it's ever legitimate to use rationales in interpreting biblical law. Now, in that position, I'm somewhat idiosyncratic. The standard position taught in Yeshivot is that one cannot. I believe that Maimonides' position certainly is that one can, and I further believe that, in fact, there never really was a position that one cannot. It's mostly a mood. Right? How confident does one have to be before one rules that way? And I think one can demonstrate that it is, in fact, impossible to construct any system of law without trying to examine its rationales. But that's the issue about whether you have a specific law, you're trying to figure out the narrow rationale for that law. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is having overall positions that go beyond specific laws, and using those broad ideological positions, moral positions, to understand law. Now, it might be that's better, and you say, of course you have to have broad values, and even if you took the position that one requires a high degree of confidence, in order to interpret laws based on their specific reasons, of course you have to take broad positions, or you can say, look, that's even more chutzpah. It's one thing to say that if God told you to do this, so we can figure out, okay, God told me to do this, right? So I can probably figure out why he meant that. It's an entirely different thing to say, well, I know what God wants overall. So whatever he tells me to do, really what he means is. Okay, so that's right. That's the broad philosophic issue. So I want to quote one particular truva of Rav Kook in this regard. This is an example that can, I think, be multiplied many, many times over. The reason I want to quote this this article of Rav Kook is that that Rav Hershel Schefter, is a prominent Rosh Hashiva at YU, wrote an article in a journal called Einayim LaTorah, a weekly parsha sheet some years ago, which regrettably I don't have, in which he said that it was kfira, it was heresy, ever to suggest that ideological motives influence Pesach. And his specific example was anyone who suggested that Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook ruled that the heter mechira, the right to sell land in Eretz Yisrael, right, worked, and you're allowed, right, and you can sell land in Eretz Yisrael during Shemitah in order to avoid the sabbatical year problems, was motivated by a desire to, right, by Zionist perspectives, as opposed to by his own specific, right, his own narrow understanding of the laws of Shemitah, was committing heresy. So in that regard, I just want to point out that if I understood our chapter correctly, then Rav Kook was committing heresy. Because if you look at tribute number one, it says, in our issue, which discusses the question of whether this is valid, Shehadachak shel bitul hayishuv v'shamamut arzeinu hakadosha, that the pressure on halacha from the question of whether Eretz Yisrael should be settled, right, and the desolation of our holy land, who gadol har v'yoter v'yoter bit erko, is a much more important value. Mehadachak shel shmir hakadosha shviyas v'peres nochrim, than the question of whether one is required to observe the sabbatical year with fruits owned by Gentiles. Right, so vaday chovahu lahadure acharei darkei aheter afilut bepirtza dechuka biyoter. So therefore, under such circumstances, it is clearly obligatory to search after pathways to permit, even if that requires entering into very narrow spaces. Now, I think, you know, if Rav Schechter is merely saying that at the end you have to have an answer that you can intellectually defend, okay, right, but that Rav Kook is entirely open in saying that, given the vast, I have the broad boulevard of halakha, and then I've got this little hole in the wall that I can sort of squeeze through, right, that he has, right, that his value judgment, that the settlement of Eretz Yisrael, right, is more important than this question of Shviyat, right, drives him. Now that position is, to some degree, what we call an ideological position. Yes, Ron?
Isn't he saying it's more imminent and not necessarily more important?
No, they're both, we're facing the choice. We can either sell the land and therefore have Eretz Yisrael be settled, but nonetheless have the land not keep Shemitah because there are all these non-Jewish on fruit orchards going on around. Or we cannot. That's our choice. And we choose one, because he says, right, because Gadol Yoter Be'erko, it's just more valuable. Yes?
The ideological position is that a ruling of Yechidra, in the Lachit sense, of given a choice between this mitzvah and that mitzvah, I have to decide if I can't manage both simultaneously, which I do. And after all, he says that maybe. How do you distinguish between what is an ideological position as from, in a matter like this, from a halakhic one of which it's what you do when you're faced with choice?
Well, because I think you listen to the language. He doesn't say technical language, right? Technical language of, well, this is an assay, that's a lot assay. But he says, I think, right, that Yishuv Eretz Yisrael and Bitul HaYishuv, right, the Shomus Arzein HaKadosha, that's broad policy considerations. It's not talking about technical. It's not talking about technical issues. It's not talking about individual chiyuvim, right? It's talking about whether, as a community, I set a high value on our, right, on making sure that the settlement in Eretz Yisrael does not collapse, and the land is not desolate. Now, of course, as a halachic ideologue, right, he will frame that, right? He will say there's halachic value to that. That's why he's framing this as halachically you have to do this. But I think the notion that he's uninfluenced by Zionism. Rav Schechter specifically said to think that Rav Kook supported the Heter Mechira and the Chazon Ish opposed it because of their different perspectives on Zionism, right, is illegitimate. No. Right? Rav Kook clearly believes that, right, that our active settling of the land is a value. Right? And if he didn't believe that, if he took the position that really we should wait for the Beit HaMikdash to come down in Eish in Hashemayim, and until then we should leave Eretz Yisrael alone, he wouldn't say that. I think that's, in a sense, right, all ideological positions break down. But I think his evaluation of the relative weight of halachot is based on his prior presumption that bringing the geula actively is a value. He uses the language of values. Gadol yoter be'erko. Okay, again, I use this mostly as an excuse to get that in. Perhaps Rav Schechter really meant it in a much narrower sense. But I'm going to argue that it's in fact entirely legitimate to look for particular positions based on ideological concerns. So what are my ideological motivations here? So on the one hand, I'm an American. And as an American, an American who's very patriotic and deeply influenced by American tradition. And so one of the things that's drummed into my head is all men are created equal. Right? So that's where universalist tendencies come from. Specifically as a Jewish American, realizing the opportunities that has given me, right? That it's good for the Jews to live in a country, right, in which people take that as a premise. On the other hand, right, so on that ground, you end up with very universalist tendencies. On the extreme other hand, Iri, of course, is dealing specifically with the context of Christianity. Right? And we should put another halakhic context. The question of how one treats Gentiles to some degree was traditionally grounded on the question of whether one viewed them as Ovdei Avodah Zarah, right, which worshippers of alien gods, which I define better as idol worshippers because it's not defined by having particular idols, right, Ovdei Avodah Zarah. We always say, well, it's much easier to relate to non-Ovdei Avodah Zarah than to Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Okay, are Christians Ovdei Avodah Zarah? So on the one hand, right, living in a majority Christian culture, which treats me nicely, I think, I don't want to relate to Christians as Ovdei Avodah Zarah. On the other hand, as a Jew, a Jew of European descent, so I come from a tradition in which many people martyred themselves, right, rather than convert to Christianity. If Christianity was not Avodah Zarah, that was a waste. There's no obligation. There's no obligation to martyr yourself, rather than engage in non-Avodah Zarah practices. So on the one hand, right, there's a motive pushing me towards saying that Christianity is not Avodah Zarah. On the other hand, I'm not really willing to say that. Right? What I really want is to be able to treat Christians as non-Ovdei Avodah Zarah, but still regard Christianity as Avodah Zarah. Now, there have been strategies that were developed in that regard. The position of the Tosafot, which we will return to, famously, is misunderstood, but it's a very attractive misunderstanding, as saying that Christianity is Avodah Zarah for us, but not for them. Right? That's how we preserve this balance. Now, I don't think that the Tosafists ever said that, but the reason that position is attractive is it lets us come out with that intermediate position. Now the Meiri really goes very far. And I guess I should say one other thing. Those are the extremes. In between, there are, number one is I want to preserve the uniqueness of Judaism. So if I say that all it takes to be a good person is X, so then why bother, right? What's special about Judaism? That's a problem. And secondly, right, one has the sense that somehow being part of a community means that you relate to members of the community differently than you relate to non-members of the community. And so there should be some way, just as family members, right, see themselves as obligated differently to each other, there should be some difference, right, between the way Jews relate and the way to each other and the way Jews relate to non-Jews. Now the Meiri, offering a way possibly to level many of those distinctions, therefore was seen as both because he seems to diminish, or is understood as diminishing the uniqueness of Judaism and diminishing the unique bonds of Jews to each other, was seen as very threatening. And because of this, a whole series of objections were raised. And I would say, really, the stark way of framing this, and I guess I'm going to quote this article again because I think I wrote it really nicely, but I said, Meiri's evident willingness to subject halakha to moral critique. And Meiri's position is to say, not just, I think this is the halakha, but I think if you don't think this is the halakha, you're doing something very wrong. And not just technically wrong, but morally wrong. Right? Because there is no justification for treating people like this. Right? So Meiri's evident willingness to subject halakha to moral critique raised alarm among traditionalists. As a result, various legends and methodological positions have grown up with the purpose of limiting Meiri's halachic and hashkafic impact. These include the claim that Meiri's works were unknown to the halachic tradition before the 20th century, that his work was published via the memorized transmission of a unique manuscript in the Vatican Library, and therefore the Jesuits had infiltrated pro-Gentile glosses into that text. And I was in yeshiva. This was, in fact, there's a very elaborate story about this, that Meiri was, of course, unknown for many, many years, and there was one man who had a photographic memory who was allowed into the Vatican Library one day a year, right? What he would do is he would read the Meiri and photograph it in his head. He would come back and write it down very quickly, right? And that's how the Meiri was published. And the Meiri was unknown before this, right? And now one has to be very suspicious because isn't it funny that a work which exists only in the Vatican Library, right? Right? It happens to have these progenitor glosses. All very nice, but regrettably not true. not true at all. If you look at the Harvard Library catalog, you'll see that the Meharry is published as early as 1830. Birkat Yosef already has a list of manuscripts in the Meharry and volumes in the Meharry published in the late 19th century. The manuscripts are not, in fact, in the Vatican, although there are, as we'll talk about later, perhaps there are there are places where there's only one manuscript, and there's even one mysterious place in which the same manuscript has been published twice, but the text is not the same, specifically with regard to Gentile Jewish issues. That manuscript has now been lost. So one of the critical places in which the Meharry says something in the Sefer Yoma, we have two publications of the same manuscript, and the words are different. Substantively different. I really don't know how to explain that.
We have copies of the lost manuscript? We know what the words were, right?
No, all we have is two different publications allegedly from the same manuscript, and they don't have the same words. It's very mysterious. But, you know, this happens sometimes. I know Professor Lyman has this great lecture called Mrs. Jonathan Abishitz's Epitaph, A Grave Matter Indeed, in which he shows you that on Rav Yonason Abishitz's wife Epitaph, the Rav Yaakov Emden publishes a picture of the gravestone, right, in which you see that there are these luchot, right, the gravestone is in luchot, and it says in big letters, Shabsai Tzvi, right, along the top of the luchot. Right? How could anyone possibly think that Rav Yonason Abishitz was not a Sabbatian? And then Heinrich Gretz, you know, publishes, he says, you know, this is, he defends Rav Yonason Abishitz against this, and he says, this is ridiculous. And he publishes a picture of the gravestone, and it's two squares, and yes, there's no place on them. And the letters Shin Bet Tav Yud Tzadi Bet Yud appear in appear. So people have strange things. So President Lyman actually went back, and he found the gravestone. And the truth is, it is Luchot. It does say Shabsai Tzvi, but it could be coincidence because it says Shabsai Tzvi in the middle of, you know, it just happens to be that the lines end in such a way that in the middle, that, you know, not that it only says Shabsai Tzvi. It's, you know, blank, you know, word ending in Shin Bas. You know, word, you know, etc. And so it just happens to be that the letters Shabsai Tzvi show up on the gravestones. But two people published it, right? You know, allegedly from life, and neither of them have it accurately. So who knows? So you have, again, so you have this yeshivish legend, which is entirely untrue. You have a position attributed to the Chazon Ish, which claims that newly discovered manuscripts can't be quoted halacha at all. This has been debated back and forth in many contexts. There's an exchange between Professor Lyman again and one other person and Rabbi Moshe Bleich in tradition in which they go through all these positions. It's clear the Chazon Ish did use manuscripts. So what he meant by that alleged comment is not clear. Furthermore, it's clear to me that this is just not true. Because manuscripts of the Ritva, the Rashba, all of these were largely unknown prior to the 20th century. They've all been published now. Nobody raises this concern with regard to any known medieval rabbi other than Meharry. Yes?
Very later about
because of uncertainties in the text?
Yeah.
Yes, you have bad manuscripts. But right, but in terms of the question of whether the fact that a manuscript from a known rabbi, right, has to, right, can't be used because it doesn't exist, we use, for example, the commentary of the Ra'avad, Mavakama and Avodah Zarah, was published for the first time in many, many years in this century. Nobody suggests you can't use it. Much of the Ritva was unknown. Right? For example, the Beit Yosef was unaware, you know, did not have the Ritva. Nobody suggests you can't use the Ritva in Yeshiva. Right? It's only because of the Meharry, and it's only because of these issues that the issue comes up at all. So that, I think, is just not true to claim that this is a broad issue. Yes.
Well, I don't get it. People are trying to go out of their way to be unhumane to Gentiles, and therefore they want to call into question the validity of the
Meharry. Well, again, I think the Meharry, because the Meharry, you know, says it in such strong language that it's clearly, he's clearly coming. The Meharry, right, basically is read as, wow, this is an ideological perspective.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't seem to have any precedent. but we'll talk about what some of the other critiques are and whether that's true. But I think that's why people resist it so strongly.
Well, before you resist that, without arguing about the validity of using benefits, so what could you say? Most of the literature don't possibly. You haven't followed that tradition before as well.
So I think, you know, there's discomfort, because if this is really a legitimate halachic position, there are a lot of things which people can defend only because there's no other option in halacha. So God told us. When you have to say we have a choice, and we're choosing that way, it becomes a lot harder.
Well, do we have a choice to follow the Hillel
Well,
close off?
Yeah, well, that's because the Gemara closed it off already. And then we're showing it's not so easy, I don't think. That's my sense of where the tension comes. I should point out that, you know, there was a tradition in Western Europe of fasting like the Meiri of David Zvi Hoffman. At least Jacob Katz claims this. I assume it's true. It's in a German book, Fasting Like the Meiri. And certainly in America, in modern Orthodoxy, up until about 25 years ago, people assumed that they fasting like the Meiri. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik very publicly fasting like the Meiri. There was such a tradition. And it was pretty open. We fasting like the Meiri because it conforms more to our sense of what living in the society is like. Okay, there's another position attributed to the Rav, I don't know if that's true, that the Meiri should be treated as the world's greatest Acharon, because he hadn't gone through the vetting process. It's a very interesting position, but again, it's not used with regard to any other Rishon in the same circumstance, so I find it hard to imagine. Okay, the...
When you say these manuscripts were not known, do you mean no one knew them?
The Meiri, we'll talk about with one exception.
In archives that hadn't been looked at, or do you just mean they were not printed so most people couldn't see them?
With the exception of two citations which we're going to talk about in a moment, the Meiri fundamentally is not quoted. Right? None of these manuscripts are quoted. From about the 14th century through the 19th century. That's probably true. And this is part of the destruction of Provençal culture by the Tosafists. right? So that basically the entire Provençal halakhic culture was wiped out by the Tosafistic revolution. Right? Just remember that this, Dr. Soloveitchik has this famous line about this. And so basically all of Provence culture, like the Ravad, right, the Ravad, Dr. Soloveitchik has shown that the Ravad, you know, wrote a commentary on the entire Talmud, which was the dominant commentary of its day, and between the 13th century and the 20th century, no one saw it. Meiri is the last generation in Provence. He has no students that we know of. I have suggested that there's a, there's one manuscript currently printed as a student of the Rashbah, which shows certain literary affinities to Meiri. And therefore, it might be that someone could get a graduate paper out of seeing if there are substantive affinities as well as literary affinities. But so far as we know, the Meiri has no students. And Meiri is really a radical thing, right? He's basically the Steinsaltz of his day. Right? You know, it's entirely different. His language is entirely different than anybody before or after him. Really, you know, he writes in a flowing conversational Hebrew, really. He rewrites the Talmud comprehensively with halachic summary. Really, you know, it's a... If he had students, you would expect them to show up. Because he really does something, that's a lot of unique things. Yes, Drew?
You mentioned that up until 25 years ago, it was just accepted that we pass him like the Meiri.
In modern Orthodoxy.
What happened since?
Self-consciousness. That'll be my take. Okay, there are also claims, and these are much more serious, we'll have to address them, that granted the Meiri says what he says, he didn't really mean it. It's not that the Jesuits put it in, but that Meiri must have been writing these things for the censors, and he couldn't possibly mean things as right, the things he says. And we'll talk about that in greater length. One of the issues for that, and this is one which I take very seriously, is that Meiri has this expansive vision of Christians, apparently, we'll talk about that, right? You know, as these humane beings, immediately after the Albigensian Crusade. That's really hard, right? They've just gone wiping out each other rampaging through, right? You know, it's not, you know, if you lived in Meiri's time, Meiri's place, you're not likely to think of Christians as all of a sudden different than the bloodthirsty Gentiles of old. Because they've just finished murdering each other. And that I find a very difficult thing to understand. Why it is Meiri specifically at this time to start making claims that his Gentiles were different. Another issue, which I'll just point out for amusement, is that people have claimed that, you know what, the Talmud says that Christians are good old-fashioned classic of the Avodah Zarah. Because the Talmud says that Nazarim, Nazarites, are of the Avodah Zarah. That's pretty clear. Right? And their holiday is Sunday. So another reason that people get is, you know, well, even if you're going to say Meiri really meant this, but he's just wrong. Right? It's just crazy to say this, because the Talmud says that Nazarim are of the Avodah Zarah. Now, Meiri had a response. He said, Nazarim doesn't mean Christians. What Nazarim really means are descendants of Nebuchadnezzar, who worship the sun. And that's why they have the holiday on Sunday. And everyone used to laugh at this. Right? Jacob Katz has this line. You know, here is an example of Meiri's Irenic personality. He was willing to create out of whole cloth this thing just to get out of those Gemara. That's what people used to think. Then in the early 90s, a Jewish historian named Leonard Zalkman published an article which he had found a travelogue. You know, this is a story, you know, we're all in legends, right? So I first heard this story from my friend Rabbi Yaakov Ginak, and he told it much better than it is in real life, so I'm going to tell it his way. And you can look up the article yourself. I think it's in JQR 1993. So in the late 19th, early 20th century, if you were a British woman of a certain class and a certain age, so you felt you had to write a book. That was what you were supposed to do. I had a friend of mine, you know, also once told me, so, you know, I feel I have a book in me. I don't know what it is, but I feel I have a book in me, and he's a throwback. Now, if you had to write a book, you had to write a book about something. But you really weren't so interested. So what you did was you traveled. And you wrote about your travels. So there was this one woman who went off to travel to the Middle East so she could write a book. And in the Middle East, she met this group of people called the Nusarai. Now, the Nusarai claim descent from the Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. And they're sun worshippers. And they have a legend about their interactions with the Jews, which corresponds to a particular Talmudic legend about the Nazarim. And the Nusarai originates in Persia during the Sassanid period, which is the time of the Babylonian Talmud. And the primary image of Nusarai theology is some kind of giant statue of the sun. And if you look in Christian literature of the Meiri's time, you can find this image infiltrated. So it turns out Meiri didn't make it up at all. Now, he might or might not be right about who the Nozrim are in the Gemara. Some people pointed out that one of the evidence for his positions is that the Nozrim referred to in one statement are referred to by Rabbi Yochanan, and the Nozrim shouldn't really be that significant yet, right? As culturally significant as Rabbi Yochanan refers to them. So theory is not ridiculous anymore on that. You know, once upon a time we thought, you know, he can't be shot in the Talmud. Now at least we know he didn't make anything up. Whether he's right or wrong, he didn't make anything up. There really were Nusarai, he had the historical period right, there really were sun worshippers, and they were around then. Okay. So I think that the claims against allowing one to rule like the Meiri, the only one which really has legs is the claim that Meiri is purely apologetic. I remember talking with my teacher, J. David Blythe, some years ago, and he said he used to take that position. He also used to be supportive of the position that it was all Jesuit scribes putting stuff in. But that became, right, that's because, as we'll see in a moment, that the Meiri was really only known through, people didn't really know the Meiri directly at all. All they knew were two citations of the Meiri on this issue in the Shita Mekubetzet, Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi's compendium of medieval literature. Rabbi Blythe said that once we had the full Meiri, you look at it and these lines show up in so many places. Right, these kind of distinctions between ancient Gentiles and current ones show up, I think, certainly more than 60 places. Very, and not in the places you would expect people who were engaged in anti-Jewish polemics to know about. So you have to assume, you know, a very thorough Jesuit forger. You know, reading through the entire, right, reading through the entire manuscript and deciding, oh, why don't I throw one of these in here? So it's just not so plausible as it was. But we're going to talk about the apologetic issue in a moment. What I want to get to now, though, is, okay, let's suppose, right, that on the first issue, can one technically paskin like the Meiri, Yes, one is entitled to Paskin on ideological grounds. Right? Yes, right, as long as one follows somewhere in the normal rules of Psak. Yes, by the normal rules of Psak, the Miri counts as a Rishon. And right, and one is entitled to Paskin like the Miri. Okay. Now the question is, do we really want a Paskin like the Miri? Right? What is involved, what's involved in Paskin like the Miri? So what do the Miri actually say? So again, what people used to know were really only two sources. Right? They didn't know the Miri himself. What the classical understanding of the Miri was until all these manuscripts were republished were two citations of Shita v'Kibetz and Devava Kama. So here's the first one. So he says, the Rabbi Meiri wrote, as a matter of law, he's dealing with a whole series of rulings that tell you under what circumstances it's legitimate to evade taxes. Right, basically, it's legitimate to evade taxes if the tax collector is out for his own good and not for the common good. A tax collector who is really an extortionist, is a thief, and you're allowed to evade the taxes. Okay. So the Meiri wrote the following. If the tax collector was of the Ovdei Ha'elim HaKidumim, is the ancient worshippers of false divinities, it's my translation, She'inam Gidurim Gidrachei HaDatot, who are not bound by the ways of the legal religions. I mean, by legal religions, I don't mean the religions that law recognizes, I mean the religions that have law. And that's going to be very important going on, and this, we'll see where that definition comes from. Okay, so if there's, a tax collector who is of these primitive ancient worshippers of false divinities, who are not bound by the ways of the legal religions, and you hid the taxes from him, so since you're not absolutely stealing, and nobody will know, okay, you can do that. Okay, right, then in another case, by the way, if you have a lawsuit between a Jew and a Gentile, and the Gentile, again, is in that category, so first you try and judge it by Jewish law, and if the Jew wins, great. And if that doesn't work, then you judge it by the Gentile's law. And if the Jew wins, that's great. You're allowed to put the Gentile in double jeopardy, basically. Meiri still said you can't make things up. You just have the choice of which legal system to use, and you should use whichever one the Jew wins in. But he says, but even when you're dealing with such people, you can't steal them. And similarly, if you're a slave, you're not allowed to escape. You have to buy your way out, because that would be theft. Okay. Then he says, however, while we say you're not allowed to steal, you are allowed to evade taxes. And also he says, you're allowed to not look for their lost objects. Okay, if one of these worshippers of the ancient religions is not bound by the ways of legal religions, right, his book Ovdei Elilim and Eino Gadur Bidrachei HaDatot, if he loses something, right, his animal gets lost, you don't have to pursue it, to return it. And even if you find his lost object, as long as he doesn't know you have it, you can keep it. Why? Because he says, Shemitzia Niksat Kinyanu, we're now in six lines to the bottom, because finding something is a partial acquisition, so it is really sort of yours. V'hachazaratan derech chasidut, and returning it is an act of piety. V'einanu kufim l'chasidut l'mish ein lo dat. And we are under no obligation to act with chasidut, with piety, towards somebody who has no legal religion. L'mish ein lo dat. Okay. However, he says, and it's the last line you need to read, this is the last paragraph in the Hebrew, Hakol shehu me'amimin ha'gdurim b'drachei ha'datot. But anybody who is from the nations that are bound by the ways of legal religions, the Odeha Elohut al Ezek Sad, and who worship the divinity in some fashion. Athol Pish emunatam rechokam emunatenu, even though their faith is distant from ours, Einam bichlal zeh, they're not included in that other category. Ela harehen kisrael gamur lebaram elu, but they're just like regular Jews for these matters, right? Absolute Jews for these matters, for lost objects, even if they make mistakes. Right, l'chol ha'shvarim below shum chiluk. Okay, for all matters without any distinction.
What is this category?
Pardon?
This whole category.
Yes.
Duryat dat. The Rambam gives you the category of gir toshim.
No, we're gonna get there. Okay. Don't jump the line. We're gonna get there. Absolutely, we're gonna get there. But well, here it makes three, maybe four important claims. Okay. Right. First, in terms of what are the types of behavior? Well, there's normal behavior and there's chasidut. Right, and towards all human beings, no matter how reprehensible, you have a certain moral obligation. You can't steal from them, for example. And he resolves that Talmudic dispute. But there's another category called chassidut, which includes returning lost objects, and that only relates to a certain category of people. It's not clear there's anything special about Jews. Right? He says, right, he's very stark language, he says, right, but in all those other matters, people who fit his categories, even though they're not Jewish, harehem ki Yisrael gamur, they're like an absolute Jew. In other places, he has even starker language. He says, he refers to them as achicha b'mitzvot, your brother in mitzvot, even though they're not Jewish. Really stark language, and if, you know, even if you have universalist tendencies in some sort, that kind of language can scare you. okay. Then, in trying to figure out which Gentiles meet this category and which don't, well, he says, well, okay, the bad ones, they belong to, may ovdei ha'elilim ha'kidumim. They belong to the ancient worshippers of false gods. Now, what makes them ancient? We don't know. That's the language already is suspicious. Right? Like the ancient, right? Well, you know, what makes them ancient? That sounds like apologetic language. Right?
Is it okay when they were new?
No, he's been claiming that the claim is, you know, that not our Gentiles. Right? If they were from those ancient Gentiles, right, who worshipped false gods, and then he has two criteria for the negative. Okay, two criteria are they worship Elilim, and they're not bound, they're not going to rim b'drachei adatot. Who are the positive ones? Well, the positive ones are gedurim b'drachei adatot, right? They're bound by the ways of religion. And, right, then he throws in a totally new line, wild line. He says, they're odei ha'alahut al-ezet sad. They worship the divinity in some fashion, even though their faith is distant from ours. Okay, now that's a line that, you know, that, what does that mean? Right? They're bound by the ways of religion, and they worship the divinity in some fashion, even though their faith is distant from ours. So that just people are going to say, what does he mean? How do you decide that somebody is worshiping the divinity? Right? What's your criteria? And does Christianity fit that criteria? Yes, Anya. Oh, very good. You know, what do you mean? It seems like you think of the only category that should determine it.
Yeah. Well,
right. But he doesn't say that. Right? He says, right, that there are two criteria. There's a daily limb and there's Gerida. Then figure out why does he care? Okay, that's a fair point because you assume that this is based on some kind of moral sense about, you know, tit for tat or something like that. But he doesn't say that. Right? He has a religious test as well. What his religious test means, we don't know. And how plausible it is that he applies this religious test to Christians? I don't know.
You could ask the further question of the track records, right? And you might say that his concern is that somebody who is over the midst of the dog for the world of sorrow, whatever that might be, out of this category. And therefore, perhaps that's what he means. Although then you would ask him, what would he say about the ethical culture of society?
Very good. We'll get to that. We'll get to all those. All right, now I'm just pointing out his language and pointing out it's not quite clear what his language means. Right, it's very, you know, worshipping the divinity even though their faith is distant from ours. Maybe that's a great description of Christianity. Right, who knows? Okay, but the other place which Miri was known is in response to, like, the classic problem of discriminatory legislation is the Mishnah of the Kama says that if a Jewish ox gores a non-Jewish ox, then the Jewish owner does not have to pay. But if a Gentile ox gores a Jewish ox, then they have to pay. Right, so this is, you know, this is sort of in your face. You know, it's in your face that both Talmuds point out, wow, that's in your face. In the Yerushalmi, you have this great line that I'm fond of, in which, in their list of discriminatory legislation, Rabban Gamliel gets up and says, and admits that one of them is a Chilul Hashem and just changes the law. Right, which is very important because it's the only place in rabbinic literature I'm aware of in which a law is explicitly changed because of a moral critique, although it's changed by rabbinic legislation. Bavli has a much more complex understanding of this, which is a separate shiur. But Meiri's response to this, in the end, is he says, right, one of the ways that Talmud justifies this inequity is by saying, you know, what happened is that God saw, based on a verse, that God saw that the non-Jews were not keeping the seven commandments. So this Meiri says, aha, mashma, this implies It doesn't actually, but let's grant that it does. Right? Mashma, the chol shem mekayim et sheva mitzvot, that so long as the Gentiles keep the seven commandments, dinam etzlenu kidinenu etzlam, that their law regarding us is like our law regarding them. Now, there are two ways of understanding that, I think, and I wasn't sure reading it. I always thought it was one way, but now I'm not sure. It could mean that, therefore, the law is the same way regarding oxen, or it could mean in this matter of oxen, right, so we judge them however they judge us. And if they discriminate, then we discriminate. If they don't discriminate, we don't discriminate. I think the simpler reading, as Miri simply says, the law is that we have to pay them just like they have to pay us. And then he says, Umayata, and now that we've said this, anybody who keeps the seven commandments, right, this inequity does not apply to them. Umayata, ain't sarit lomar, there's no need to say, that this applies to nations that are bound by the ways of legal religions and their laws. Okay, now this statement here seems to be a much more straightforward equity issue. Right? It's not that they're, right, you know, we can't treat them unfairly as long as they're the Sheva Mitzvot. They keep the Sheva Mitzvot. But this very interesting line, which seems to imply that Gudrim B'drachei HaDatot goes well beyond keeping the seven commandments. Right? Because keeping the seven Noahide commandments, that's his original idea. And he said, now that I've said that, of course you don't have to bother saying it about Gentiles who have, right, who belong to their own legal religions. Okay, that's what was known about Meiri. And, right, and basically it was used just as to, people tended to focus on the common ground, which is that there's some obligation of equity towards Gentiles who basically keep the Sheva Mitzvot, and people pretty much ignored the religious aspects. Although, you know, there was some tension about exactly how to do that. But it really wasn't so much to build on. Because Mary had these two comments. The first one makes so many wild claims, no one quite knew what to do with it. But what you could say was as follows. It sounds like for Meiri, a minimum is keeping the Sheva Mitzvot, right, the seven commandments. One of the seven commandments is not to commit Avodah Zarah. Right? So if the Meiri is saying that nations bound by the ways of religion are better than people who keep the Sheva Mitzvot, and he's talking about Christianity, then Meiri must believe that Christianity is not Avodah Zarah. Right? That was, right, that was the argument the way it was understood. Now there was another debate, a scholarly debate, mostly associated with Jacob Katz and Ephraim Orbach, as to whether Meiri was halachically creative or only ideologically creative. Now, did Meiri actually end up doing anything that people had done before? Was he really trying to change the law? Or was it that, of course, nobody was going to enforce differing tort laws because it would be dangerous? Right? Right? Nobody was going to... Right? In fact, it was a chilul Hashem if you found a Gentile lost object and didn't return it. All Meiri did was say, you know what, the reason to do this is not because of chilul Hashem, right, or because of Shum Eva, because we're afraid they'll hate us. It's because, really, we're obligated towards them. Right, that was Ephraim Orbach's position. Jacob Katz argued that no, Meiri was actually a creative halachic force. Question, Josh?
Yeah, is there more questions just to say that Meiri has different expectations for the individual as opposed to the community?
What do you mean?
That according to the individual, I expect you to observe the Shabbos and then Noah. And that will catapult you into our laws and our sphere, whereas if you're a community, if you're an ummah, you just have to be moved over to Darkei Das.
And you don't have to keep the Sheva Mitzvot?
It's not... if you're an individual, if we're donning up at an individual level, yes, but if we're thinking of you as a community, it's almost like a Tinuk Shanishma.
That's an interesting claim. Let's see if you still hold it at the end.
Okay.
Okay, Katz and Orbach had this debate. Do you have a question? Yeah, let me reset this. So the question is, but other people could reach the same conclusion by different means. I can claim that you always have to be careful, right, not to keep a Gentile lost object because they'll hate you, because if it gets out, they'll hate you. And of course, so therefore you have to return Gentile lost objects. I don't have to make any claims about them being special. It's because they're murderers. That's why we have to return their lost objects.
So everyone's saying that Miri took this to the law.
Yeah, everyone says Miri took this to the law. The question is his conclusion radical or only his reasoning? Right, so Katz said his conclusion was he reached radical conclusions, and Orbach said no, only his reasoning. Now that debate was conclusively settled by Moshe Halbertal in part of his book on the Meiri, which the chapter on this, which we're doing now is published in the first volume of the Eidah Journal, And whether it's because he sat down and read through the entire Ni'iri, which would be impressive, or whether, like me, he has a computer program which lets you search out keywords, all is right. So we no longer have to limit ourselves to the 8 or 10 examples that Katz came up with. You know, now we can just list hundreds, you know, at least, you know, tens and I think I have at least 65, something like that, examples, and I only have like 3 that Albertel doesn't have. Really show that Ni'iri says this in lots and lots and lots of places, and at least some of them is radically creative halakhically. So that issue, I think, is settled, probably. That Ni'iri really says it in places that have radical practical implications, not just theoretical implications. But Halbertal also, in the process of doing this, comes up with a further claim, a very strong claim as to how to understand Ni'iri, which puts it in much sharper ideological relief than just some kind of vague sense which people had before, not really reading him so closely and saying, well, Ni'iri thinks that if they're nice to us, we should be nice to them, and if they're basically good people, then we should be basically good to them. You know, people understood the implication of Ni'iri that somehow, you know, it sounds like Christians are not the Avodah Zarah, but that wasn't the critical point. And Halbertal made this claim that that Ni'iri is actually very precise. What he says is that Halbertal says, you know what, there are 3 categories of legislation regarding Gentiles. One, he says, is legislation. We call category A is legislation. Am I blanking on this? There's legislation. There's the civilly discriminatory legislation, like tort law. That's A. Then there's B, which is attempts to avoid contact with Avodah Zarah, and C, which are laws designed to prevent you from marrying Gentiles. And what he says is that Ni'iri never permits anything in category C. He maintains the social barriers between Jews and Gentiles. Whenever Ni'iri refers to categories associated with Avodah Zarah, he only uses religious language, Ovdei Elilim, right, and doesn't talk about bound by the ways, but Gadur B'Shrechei Hadat, doesn't talk about moral behavior. And when he talks about civil discriminatory law, that's when he uses the language of Gadur B'Shrechei Hadat. Right? So he says, actually, Ni'iri has a very carefully worked out position about how halakha ought to be. Right? That if you're bound by a dot, then we don't civilly discriminate against you. If you have a proper idea of God, or at least a close enough idea of God, then we don't have to treat you, right? We don't regard you as an idolater. And finally, but nonetheless, unless you're Jewish, we're not going to marry you. Right? And in case you think I'm saying this too strongly, right, I gave you the exact quote, right, which the key line is, he says, it is no coincidence that the second distinction between umot hagdurot, lo gdurot, right, never appears, right, in omafia klal, beheter isur maga kifim mevarat elulim, in terms of revoking prohibitions involving indirect contact with idolatry, and the English translation is authorized as well. As I'm quoting Halbertal directly. Okay. So if Halbertal is correct, then we really have to take Ni'iri at his most radical, which is not only is Ni'iri saying that you have to treat Christians nicely, but you also have to say that Christianity is not a Avodah Zarah, right, Ni'iri is very precise about saying this. Right? He uses this terminology specifically to say that the reason that I allow these things which are indirect contact with idolatry is not the same reason that I change the civilly discriminatory legislation. Right? It's a very clearly worked out position. Now, a different position, as alternative, is worked out by Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin in response to B'nai Vanim, and what I think is a really impressive piece. So he says, according to Ni'iri, he starts off with his own, Michael Broyd, right, is fond of referring to this. He says, in law school, this is referred to as the giggle test. Can you say something with a straight face? If you can't say it with a straight face, it can't be true. Right? So basically, what Hankins says is, there's a person here. There's a statue there. Right? This person is on his knees before that statue praying. And you're going to say, oh, that's not a Avodah Zarah. No, you're not going to do that. Right, that's his bottom line. Right, you're going to say there's a tray of bread and wine here, and somebody walks up to you and says that's the blood and flesh of my God. No problem. Right, that, right, that Reagan just says, look, you can't say that. And nobody could ever, right, and nobody could ever have said anything like that with a straight face. Right, that's his, you know, I have my own problem with essay, which is martyrdom, right, which is if Mary really believes that Christianity is not Abodazara in any sense, then, right, then he's saying that the martyrs basically gave up their lives for nothing. And that, I think, would have been fundamentally inconceivable, it's still fundamentally inconceivable for somebody Jewish to say that. To have said that in the, right, said that after the Crusades, right, is just, you know, it was just, you know, beyond the boundaries of plausibility, I think. So Rav Henkin makes a different argument. He says, he says that there, Meiri in fact has two categorizations, right? He says there's number one, he says that Christians are not, right, he says that the people who rejects, right, the Avodah Zarah Kedemim, right, means that they're not bound by the ways of religion, meaning with boundaries and prohibitions, but rather, and this is a quote from Meiri, Kol Avirav V'chol Kiur Yafah Be'neihem, with the Gentiles that Meiri deprecates, they have a completely inverted morality. All ugliness is beautiful in their eyes. Right, which is opposed to Christianity, which forbids and punishes sexual transgressions and other abominations. So Meiri thinks Christianity doesn't meet that category. Secondly, he says that those ancient alien worshippers, right, of David Azarah, do not concede, right, to the belief in divinity. Rather, they worship, right, meaning they don't worship the divine creator of heaven and earth. Rather, they worship idols and stars and telizmash, I don't know what those are. And all those are the essence of Avodah Zarah. Okay, so now, Rabbi Henkin says, and he's, you know, Hamilton and he agree on this, these two positions are connected, because Meiri believes that if you believe in multiple gods who conflict, you can't have any kind of moral legislation. Because what this god likes, that god won't like. Right, so you have to believe in one authority over the world. Right, that's a prerequisite for a moral culture. Now then Rav Henkin comes up and says, you know what? Since in Christianity the Trinity cannot have conflicting wills, so Christianity meets that test. Right? Christianity does not believe in conflicting authorities, right, that make it impossible to generate moral legislation. Yes?
Leaving gods out of this.
Yeah.
Let's think of the United States government. Right? I mean, we have various centers of authority that are in fact conflicting.
Yeah.
And we don't say you can't have any kind of law or morality because the Supreme Court says one thing.
Good. Okay. Hold until the end, we're evaluating whether he's right. Right now, I just want to find out what Meiri says.
Okay.
Then at the end, we'll talk about whether we can reach the conclusions we want to reach based on him, and whether we have to find his reasoning compelling.
Well, there is the question of whether Rabbi Henkin correctly understood Meiri. Sure.
Yes. This is, although I say at this point, Rav Henkin and Professor Halpich are not in any disagreement. Right, the only thing Rav Henkin comes along and he says, you know what? Meiri never addresses the technical question of whether Christianity is Avodah Zarah. Because obviously, if you bow down to a statue, you're an Avodah Zarah. That's not his issue. And Meiri says, in terms of determining whether we treat you properly or not, right? In that regard, Meiri says, that's a function of whether you have the kind of religious beliefs that can generate a moral culture. In terms of the question of how we relate to your worship, well, guess what? You bow down to idols. You think your god is flesh. Right? That's pretty clear. Okay, right? So what he ends up saying, here my student Josh Harrison, I thought, had a great formulation. Right? He says, the Meiri has to distinguish between Avodah Zarah Shel Toiva, abominable idolatry, and Avodah Zarah Sheina Shel Toiva, and non-abominable idolatry. It's still idolatry, but it doesn't carry the same degree of moral opprobrium. And this, I think Rav Henkin gets it absolutely right, that the Gemara, I think he quotes this, not my idea, but I think he quotes it, that the Talmud has this really peculiar idea that that idolaters outside the land of Israel aren't really idolaters, they're just carrying on ancestral customs. What it means is that they don't have the fundamental beliefs. They don't really believe in paganism, which is what generates all these moral evils in his vision. Right? And I tend to agree, you know, that some of my students know that I think that paganism is defined in biblical culture as the attempt to achieve transcendence through sex and violence. And that, right, and that's what generates all the moral evils that they're rejecting about. It's a perversion of the physical. So if you're just carrying on these rites, you don't really understand what they're about anymore, then it doesn't generate the same thing.
So Rav Hankin makes the claim, right? Picking it up right after the right after the ellipses, right? It says Samiri, right? Just Samiri. Therefore, because of the unity issue, right? Because of the unity of authority issue, right? Meiri thinks that Christianities are Odeya Lahutel Ezit Sad. They worship the God in some form, even though their belief is distant from ours. But he says, and this is indeed a great rationale for distinguishing between Christianity and other forms of Avodah Zarah, even though bowing to an image of Jesus certainly is Avodah Zarah in the opinion of Meiri as well. And here Hagen writes, as opposed against one who erred regarding Meiri's intent, which I assume is Professor Halbertal. Right? And he brings some series of evidence. He says, if you look closely at Meiri's comments on Avodah Zarah Bet and Bavim Bet, where Meiri talks about why we are allowed to engage in commerce, right, nowadays with Gentiles, even on their holidays. So Meiri was very careful not to write that there's no Avodah Zarah in Christianity, but he only writes only that there's no decree regarding them. In other places he writes that Yishma'ilim are not of the Avodah Zarah, but he never writes that about Christians. Right, he says explicitly that there are positions that hold that Yishma'ilim, right, are not of the Avodah Zarah, and he never says it about Christians. And therefore, Hankin comes up with a very interesting position that there is nothing in Christian belief about the unity of God that is a violation of Avodah Zarah, but bowing to images and belief in a transubstantiation are Avodah Zarah, and therefore he ends up saying that he thinks that Unitarian Universalists are not of the Avodah Zarah. But certainly Roman Catholics are, Episcopalians, and most of the sects, most sects which have either image worship or Eucharist are, rather he defines the Mass, are of the Avodah Zarah.
You have to be careful
Yes, you have to be careful, right? You have to check the theology. It, right, according to Hank, you have to check the theology of each church, and then you have the interesting issue, which we talked about in the program 2 years ago in the published Shavuot. How do you evaluate the status of whether I can walk into a church? Is that defined by the theology of the denomination, or the theology of the minister, or the theology of the majority of the congregants? A Unitarian Universalist, and this is a big deal, because the movement officially has a very vague idea of God, but there's been this revival of specific Christian God talk, right, among certain versions of the movement. Right, and the members may have entirely different positions. So you have all sorts of interesting halakhic questions as to how you define that. In general, I tend to allow walking into Unitarian Universalist churches. Okay, but I don't know enough about most other Protestant sects. Okay, so now let's test Halbertal's thesis, right? Because the fundamental claim Halbertal makes is that Meiri thinks that there is no Avodah Zarah in Christianity, and therefore you can be engaged with their worship, right? And all those prohibitions are removed. And Rabbi Hankin claims, no, you can't do that. And Halbertal makes this claim based on this terminological precision. So here I have to make a reference to, I always quote Rabbi Saul Berman, taught me this, the notion of predictive principles in halakha. Right, if I want to set up the claim that A always goes with B, right, so I have to know in advance whether a certain object is going to be B or not. Right, so Professor Halbertal has these three categories, right, which are civil discrimination, indirect contact with idolatry, and social contact. So, and there's like these 60, 70 different cases. So I had my students, what I did was instead of giving them Professor Halbertal's neat categorizations, I gave them all these cases in the order of the Talmud, and I said, take every case and put it in either category A, B, and C. And it turns out that it's not a very good predictive, the categories are not good predictive principles. And on the whole, except for a few cases, the students distributed randomly as to whether these laws fell into category A, B, or C. So it's difficult to test Professor Halbertal's thesis on a broad level. Because
what are the three categories A, B, and C again?
Civil discrimination, indirect contact with idolatry, and social contact leading to marriage.
What's the fear in the last one with the social contact?
We're afraid that we're going to intermarry.
But that's
perfect.
Okay.
That's that. But so for example, right? If I say that you're not allowed to eat bread baked by Gentiles, is that because we don't want you eating with them and they'll marry them, or
We don't want you digging them and then you worship them with them. Or is it really a case of...
We don't want you to fall in love with the baker's daughter.
Right. Or is it a case of that we want to favor Jewish bakeries? Right? You can fit it, right? You can fit it in each of these categories. And the Talmud and the Meiri don't always tell you which is which. So it's tough to predict.
Well,
yes, Trish.
But forbidding Yayin, I think, rather this whole chain. And eventually they say, we forbid Darach and Tanah Darach here.
Yeah, wine is a particularly complicated case.
Right, so I think Rashi says the first Darach here is Intermirror, and the second Darach is Vodazara.
Yeah.
Vodazara is the penultimate.
Right, so wine is a particularly complicated case. Right, we're not going to talk about how to predict that at all. So Miri thinks there were two different Zero at different times. It's a mess. Oh, but I'll give you, here's a simple case. Okay? You see a destroyed non-Jewish building of worship, and you say, "Yay, God! We destroyed this house of worship." Okay, and now Meiri says, "Ah, but that means right. That's only of those ancient religions, etc. Not these people." Okay, is that social context?
No.
No. Is that civilly discriminatory legislation? No. That's contact with idolatry, right? That's your opinion of their religion. So if Professor Albertel were right, Meiri should, right, I quote again, right, he should only refer to, right, to their religious contact and not to being during Midrashei Adatot. Right? That's about as clear a case as you can get. It has nothing to do with civil legislation, it has nothing to do with socialization, it's only talking about our opinion of their religion. Right? And Professor Albertel said, I'm going to quote it again, he said, it is no coincidence that the second distinction never appears, right, between Gedurim and non-Gedurim, never appears in the context of revoking prohibitions involving indirect contact with idolatry.
Well, you can argue that this is stating what you say when you see a destroyed building. You're not. Indirect contact with idolatry is I don't sell the things that they may use for idolatry.
Right, but if I think, so the statement is literally true, perhaps, right, even with this.
Yeah.
Right, that it doesn't occur in the context of revoking prohibitions. But if we say Meiri uses these terms rigorously, and when he's talking about religious evaluations, he uses Ovdei HaElohut, and when he's talking about civil legislation, he uses Gedurim, this has nothing to do with civil legislation.
Granted that, but there's a distinction between that Dr. Habakkuk's classes are not really only inclusive, they're things that are not in those classes.
Right, but again, but it's the same basis.
The discussion about evaluating religion is you know, maybe it's Rabbi Flapper's discussion. Right? Understanding of Professor Habakkuk's
contracts.
Yeah. Right? So it doesn't seem to be what he
said. I mean, I don't know. It seems to me that Professor Habakkuk shouldn't say here, as it does, of course, right? That right, Batei Ovdei HaElohim Ushar Baleha Menot HaKdumot Shelo Hayu Gdurot Bidrachei HaDat. Right? It doesn't belong there. Right? If his claim is true, it just doesn't belong there.
Well, but no, if you think, like in the Erie, that if you want to make some distinction between the Vodazara, which is, you mentioned something
came
up with, a Vodazara, which is to Ava, and the Vodazara, which is also even to non-Jews, which is in that category, then it might be reasonable to say that your response to a destroyed building depends on which of those categories.
But then he shouldn't mention the Ovdei HaElohim, right? He should just mention Gedurot then, if it just depends on that.
Okay,
yeah,
that's fair.
Yeah, I think it's hard to sustain. And this example can be multiplied. On the inverse side, right, so what about the rule that you're not allowed to cook for Gentiles, you're not allowed to cook for Gentiles on Yom Tov because you have no obligation to feed them. And here he says that only applied to those Gentiles, not our Gentiles. Now, what are we talking about? We're not talking about contact with idolatry, because you can feed, right? Because it's only a prohibition on Yom Tov, not during the week, right? We're not talking about marriage. We're clearly talking about civilly discriminatory legislation, right? So we can cook for us and not for them, I think. And here he makes no mention of Durim B'Drachei HaDatot, right? Here he only refers to Ovdei HaElohim. That's source number four. So on a just the flat level, I'm just giving you these two examples, but I could multiply them. It just doesn't seem to me convincing that Meiri's terminology is consistent. Again, it's difficult to measure because there's so few cases which are clear. I thought I gave you what I thought the two cases which are easiest to predict, and Meiri reverses his language. That's A. Now question B,
what does Mary really think, right? We've been working on the assumption that the good guys all through this are Christianity, right? Even though Mary never says that in many of these places. He just distinguishes between the bad old people and the good people. He doesn't tell you which people are good, right? Which of the current people are good. So in on Sanhedrin Lamaket Amud Aleph, here he writes the following. A person should always be eager to learn Torah, right? Kidei lahashich et apikoros, so as to silence the heretics, the apikoros, right? Hamutziim misham rayot limenoteim hakdumot, who bring from there proofs for their ancient religions. Benichshalim bemenot hashniyut, and fall into the trap of dualism. Ushaar avodot shel tzva hashamayim, and other beliefs in the right, in the hosts of heaven. And he gives an example of people who say Naaseh Adam, right? It refers to a multiple god. Now the question here is, what kind of pagan religion brings proofs from the Bible? What kind of ancient religion? Right? So here he says a person should always be ready to learn Torah, so that you can counteract the biblical proofs.
Suzuki?
That's a joke.
Are they Zoroastrians brought biblical proof?
They were
okay, so maybe there were, right? Maybe there were faith that someone took the Bible as sacred in Talmudic times, right? Which Mary doesn't think, right? And Emunat HaShniut doesn't sound so Christian. Dualism, Christians would be Emunat HaShlishiut. Okay, in source number 9.
Yeah, of course, doesn't normally refer to Jews who do not follow what we consider Tarshish Baal
Peh. Right, but he says Emunoteim Hakdumot. Right, and he refers to them as Avodot Shel Tzva Hashamayim.
I don't think this is an instance of these people viewing the Bible as a sacred text. I mean, this is typical of instances where they only attempt to use the Tanakh, the Torah, to convince Jews that there's something wrong with their beliefs. And there are such stories that certainly exist from ancient times. I don't think it's claiming that they are believers in it. It's not claiming that they are Christians who believe in the Old Testament. It's claiming that these are people who want to cite Scripture in order to convince you of some of their beliefs, but because they think you believe it, not because they believe it.
Okay, let's see if you say the same thing about the next one. Okay, Sifrei Minin, right? Books of Minim, whoever those are, right? Also some kind of derogatory term for wrong believers. V'hein shekatvum haminim la'atzmam achar shenishtam du. These are the books that the Minim wrote for themselves after they apostatized. Okay, so we're talking about some kind of faith that attracted Jews. Including books that they wrote as polemics about our faith. Even though there are many biblical verses written in them, which they use as proofs for their words. You don't save these. Harder. Harder to think that this is not talking about Christian filling. Now, at the end of this, he says, right, now, you have to be very careful. He says, right, next time, right, as a literary form, they said about this, right, if a lion is running after you, you should run into a batei of the Avodah Zarah and out into their houses. So maybe they're not of the Avodah Zarah, they're just something worse. And that's only because they're Jews who are nishtameh. Although, that's, at this point, it's hard to say that he's talking only about, right? Only about Jews who apostatized to Christianity. That's not what he's talking about in his time, right? By his time already, most churches are not just of Jewish apostates, and the polemics are not just written by Jewish apostates.
But a lot of them were.
So you could get out of this, right? You can say, you know what? You're right here in number 8. He's referring to Zoroastrianism, Gnosticism, Mithraism, whatever it may be. And number 9, he's referring only to texts written by Jewish apostates and or to and or he's not really calling them Odei Avodah Zarah, he's just calling them Minim. I just think that it's harder to do this. Right? You know, the pressure on saying this is difficult. Okay, source number 10.
What?
Pardon?
The pressure to say what?
That Leary thought of Christians as Odei Avodah Zarah.
No, it's on the contrary.
Yeah.
This proves that he thought of them as something worse in certain respects than Odei Avodah Zarah, and not as Odei Avodah Zarah.
Yes, I said you could read source number 9. I said you could read source number 9 and say, since it says you should go unto Betei Avodah Zarah, not to those,
right.
so they're not technically Avodah Zarah, they just happen to be worse.
They're worse in the respect of being more attractive, and yeah. More dangerous.
Worse in the sense of being more attractive.
That's what he's worried about.
He's not talking about civil interaction and social interaction. He's talking about books and burning these books and dissing yourself in these books precisely because they're so close to Judaism and you don't want to be attracted to them. But in Akhenami, in terms of social relations and judgment, he still might maintain what he said in Baba Kama.
So their religion is not Avodah Zarah, it's just horrible.
No.
But not their horrible.
No, we're talking
the religion.
About apostate Jews here, right?
It's exactly the point you were making about the Shmud, that he has to maintain that it's a disaster to become a Christian. Right?
Uh-huh. It's a disaster to become Christian, just not Avodah Zarah.
It doesn't, he's not, he explicitly says that, you know, it's worse than
it's worse than Avodah Zarah, it's just not Avodah Zarah.
It just seems to me that this worse to be paragraph is talking specifically about apostate Jews, and those are the ones you're supposed to refer to, okay, Avodah Zarah, whether he's referring to Christians there or something else, I don't know. But, I mean, when he says to go these, the house of Avodah Zarah, not these ones, he's talking about the apostates and their books, which is Jews.
Okay.
He says they look like human
Yeah, the
only the people who knew the truth and were apostate.
So it could be that, you know, he's complacent with non-Jews who do this, and it's really just Jews. Okay, we can say that. Well, the problem with this is that in a one of the radical places, Neri suggests one of the which we're not going to get to today is that he suggests that conversion outworks. And so this reading of this will contradict that. Neri says that if a Jew converts to another religion, then we judge the Jew as a member of that other religion. Which
that would seem to contradict any number of explicit converts about the apostate is producing a conclusion.
No,
you're
talking about civil.
No. Mary may distinguish between a Mumar and a Meshumar. Mumar Shakita is sure, because he's still Jewish. Right, his condition, right? But if you really convert out, you're not Jewish anymore. That was a Gaonic position.
How do you distinguish between
the Mumar Avodah Zarah hasn't joined the other religion. He just worships, but he hasn't cut himself off from Judaism. He's a Jew who worships Avodah Zarah. Hard. Okay.
All churches full of them.
Yeah, oh, I know, right in Harvard Square. we'll see. Perhaps we'll eventually have Swedenborgian Jews if the church, so that's where they meet. Source number 10. Right, so we're going back. All right, this is a parallel context in areas. So number 10, right, is an area which we saw already. Right, talking about civil legislation. Right, theft and things like that. And here again, Neri mentions, right, their religious beliefs and doesn't limit himself to talking about Gdorim B'drachei Hadat. So it's true, Professor Halberthal only makes the claim one way. He says he never mentions Gdorim B'drachei Hadat about religious matters, but it should be consistent. It's not, and it's not even consistent the way he says it. I frankly don't think it's so, I really don't think it's supportable to make the claim that the terminology is used precisely. What does Neri really think about Christianity? Let's say, even if he doesn't have the terminology consistent, right, what does he really think? So source number 11, right, and now we're certainly in, source number 11, we're certainly again, will you tell me which category? It says, Ovdei Gluim, You don't have to refrain from greeting worshippers of these, right, the bad religious dudes. Okay, but you shouldn't engage in extra long greetings with them, as opposed to the good ones. Okay. Now, what category are we in here? Well, if it's social contact, then Miri permits it, so that would be bad news, right? That Halbertal, sorry, that would destroy the whole claim. So since Miri is going to permit it, it's got to be either category A or B, according to Professor Halbertal, right? Now, is this civil discrimination, or is this avoiding indirect contact with idolatry? Should be the second category, right? And therefore, what should Miri mention? Only of Deha Elohut, and not mention anything about Gderim B'drachei Adat, right? What does he say? Umikol makom umot hagdirot b'drachei hadatot. Again, I just don't think that the claim holds up.
Okay, but he's got another further thing, which is a novel language.
Oh, good. Okay, now having, I think, you know, for at least for my purposes, said that we can't rely on the claim that Miri has this very distinct language to tell us what Miri thinks of Christianity. Now we have to look at what he actually says everywhere. So what he says here is, so those nations that are gderot b'drachei hadatot, u'ma'aminim b'mitziyuto yitbarach l'achduto v'yecholto, right, and they believe in the existence of the Holy One who is blessed, l'achduto v'yecholto. In terms of his, what's achduto, what do you think?
Unity.
Ah, that would be yichudo.
Uniqueness.
All right? Complicated. Right? Viecholto, and it's omnipotence. So those people, right, who believe in the divinity in some form, including, right, his existence, his power, and his uniqueness.
Singular.
His question is, how would you say uniqueness? Maybe it's unity. Okay, you think unity. Fine, let's say unity. Maybe that's right. Maybe I'm reversing it.
It's oneness.
Oneness, okay. Okay, good. So now we should be happy. So the question is, first of all, is that a plausible thing to say about Christianity of all the things?
No.
All the things we're going to say about Christianity, right? If the good guys in the area are Christians, to say they refer to, right? If you think achduto means unity, that's a push.
Well, they say they believe in one God.
Yeah, so it's possible to say, and I used to think this also. Look, if you ask a Christian, do you believe in one God, even a different Trinitarian, of course. If they believe in three gods, they also say, of course. So why should we believe one as opposed to...
No, they don't.
One God.
Three persons. Yeah, so you believe it or not, so we say, look, you know, you say things that look contradictory to me, I'll be Donnie Lukavskut. And I'll take your one, you know, when we brought in Phil Cunningham from the Boston College Center for Jewish Christian Learning to the program 2 years ago, to talk about this issue specifically. So people tried to get an answer that made sense in that. Right? You know, and he gave a very powerful presentation. At the end of it, no one could make up their minds. you know, on all these issues. You know, what does it mean to bow down to statues? And, you know, some students came out saying, wow, that's the Vodazara. And some people said, no, that's exactly what I do. And, right, it was very, very confusing. Okay. So here he goes on to say, even though they confuse a few things according to our faith. Now, are these the same people, right, who we referred to as right, in the Vakama as Shemunatam Rifokam Emunatenu? Anyway, he has two descriptions of these worshippers of the divine in some form. One is that they're distant, even though their faith is distant from our faith. The other is that they share our belief in his unity and his omnipotence. Right, and even though they confuse a few things, it's tough to know. Right, if he's talking about, can he possibly be talking about the same people? Well, the descriptions are deeply problematic. So at least that, you know, I don't know who Miri is talking about where, in this regard. In Sanhedrin Samach Bet Amud Aleph, Miri deals with the question of whether one is allowed to engage in a partnership with a Gentile because there's a fear that a Gentile will. If one has a partnership with a Gentile, at some point you'll have a business dispute. The Gentile will be obligated to take an oath in court that he didn't steal from you, and he'll take the oath by his God, and so you will have violated the prohibition against causing other gods to be mentioned by you. In that regard, Meiri says, as many of the Tosafists already said, that we no longer apply this. Now Meiri should say we no longer apply this because guess what? Right, you should use all this classic terminology. Right? Because in the Halberthal you should say because they worship God in some form. Right? Instead, Meiri does is quote the Tosafists. And what the Tosafists say is this narrow claim that when they say God, their intent is for the creator of heaven and earth. Now, some versions of Tosafists are more radical and say that even when they say the name Jesus, they intend the creator of heaven and earth. And that's much more radical. All I want to point out here is, and it's all I can do for now, in a different version of the Shira, I'll make this in a greater length, is that Meiri doesn't see himself as saying something different than the Tosafists. Right? On this issue, right, as opposed to using his own terminology, Meiri simply quotes the Tosafists. Right? He doesn't say Christians aren't of Avodah Zarah. He simply takes the Tosafistic solution. That seems to me to tell you that he's not seeing himself as saying something radical. And since the Tosafists certainly thought Christianity was of Avodah Zarah for some purposes, right, it seems to me that Meiri unlikely not to have thought that as well. Okay, so on the question of whether Meiri thought Christianity was Avodah Zarah, the terminological claim doesn't work. What he actually says is difficult to figure out. Now the other issue we have to talk about is, yes?
So, but if you are going to argue that it, which I think you said at the beginning, that this is ideological, then he will say a stronger thing or a weaker thing depending on how much he needs to make his ideological conclusion.
So you want to say that Meiri is just okay leaving it here because there is another way of getting the same conclusion, and he should only say his ideological claim, right, when he needs to. The problem with that is that, as Orbach pointed out, there are many places where Meiri says this even though the same conclusion is reached by the Tosafists on other grounds. So it's not consistent. It's not consistent that way.
Shut down by a fact.
You can claim that this is a more famous position reaching that, so he's okay saying it. You could do it. It's not perfect, I think, though. Okay. So the next issue we have to address is, to what degree is Meiri apologetic as opposed to real? So Meiri in Yevamot Tzadichet Amud Aleph says the following. We hold halachically that Gentile eternity doesn't count for a whole bunch of purposes. Okay, now here he says, now why do we hold that Gentile eternity doesn't count? You could say that we suspect that Gentile women, you know, aren't monandrous, and therefore we have no way of knowing. Right? Whereas among Jews we presume that the primary sexual partner is the husband, and therefore we have a presumption of paternity. By non-Jews we simply don't have that. So Mary says, no, that's wrong. And he says, the proof of that is if you have twin brothers who convert. Now twins, we all know perfectly, right, Meiri believes, twins can only come from the same father. Okay, which is certainly a very plausible description of the vast majority of cases. Right? And he makes this as a medical claim. Twins have, right, you can't be born as twins from different fathers. Yes, I know we have cases now where that's not the case, but that's his assumption. Okay. And within that world, he says, or you could claim that you have a husband and wife locked up in jail alone for a year, and nobody else has access to them. That would also prove it. Nonetheless, he says, right, we hold that Gentiles have no paternity. Then he says, Kachu adin, this is the rule, kol shehu me'avdei ha'elilim, so long as he's one of these idol worshippers, ve'eino begeder adatot, and not in the bounds of legal religions. Now, the problem with this is, nowhere, to my knowledge, and I'm welcoming invited, no one ever in halachic history has suggested that twins of Christian parents who convert are still halachically related to each other.
Or Muslim parents.
Right? No one, right? You know, whereas even Meiri's radical position about converting out.
Well, wait a second. Yeah. Can't be right either, because non-Jews have a relationship on your mother's side. And right. One thing you're sure about, twins, they got the same mother.
Right.
So I don't quite, what would they not be? I mean, they can't marry
No.
Was it boy or girl? They can't.
No. So we generally rule, right, that Gershon is guy or Kikat and Shanola dummy, right? That a convert has no relationship, right? Has no relationship with family at all.
We don't do that for a riot, the mother and son.
Yes, we do. The Oraisa we do. We just make a Gzeira Drabanan that nobody should say that somebody converted only so they could, you know, solve their Oedipal problem. Right, this was my one of my great Purim pieces, I think. It was making the claim anybody who says Oedipus Rex sinned is an error, right? That's how they claim. So the play was called Oedipus Rex Gera Maleki. Right, Oedipus Rex the Amalekite convert, in which he discovers that it was permitted to sleep with his mother in a mitzvah to kill his father. Apparently, Professor Shalom Karmi has in fact written the play. That's where I came up with the idea. It's like a very long script. The Oraisa we rule that way. Well, that, right, but we say Shalom Bami Kedusha Chamura LaKedusha Kala. Okay. If you take this Meiri at face value, he says that, right? He says that twins born from non-idolatrous Gentile parents are still related to each other after conversion. Now, as opposed to even his most radical position about conversion out, which has Gaonic precedent, I at least don't know of anywhere else in halachic history where this was suggested. So, it makes one wonder. It makes one wonder. What's going on there? Now, on the other hand, that is a real. Here we get back to ideology. Right, so we talked about the inequity in civil law as something that the Talmud uses as the classic example of problem with Gentiles. But the one that bothers most contemporary yeshiva students is saving Gentiles on Shabbat. Right, or more to the point, not saving Gentiles at the cost of violating Shabbat. Right, that's the one which just sort of sets the test. You know, you'll save, right, the halakha says you should save you should save Jews even at the expense of Chilul Shabbat, but not save Gentiles. Now we have, in fact, in practice, solved that by saying that Mishum Eva, right, that we take the Talmudic exception and make it the rule, and we say that, in fact, and that this is, in fact, the case, practically, that if it ever got out that a Jew failed to save a Gentile when they would have saved a Jew at the risk of violating Shabbat, that would cause a pogrom. All right, and so therefore we don't do this now. But there's a moral tension in saying we only do it, Mishum Eva, right, and not because, right, of the value of human life. This is best expressed in a classic yeshivish joke about Professor Saul Lieberman of the JTS and Morton Smith, who was the great non-Jewish scholar of Jewish history, in which allegedly Professor Smith goes to Professor Lieberman and says, "Tell me, if I were in a burning building on Shabbat, would you violate Shabbat to save me?" And Professor Lieberman says, "Of course." And then Smith says, "Ah, but would you save me because of the innate value of human life? Or would you save me because Mishum Eivah?" And Professor Lieberman says, "Of course I would save you because of the innate value of human life." And Smith leaves happy. And Lieberman calls over the nearest Jew and says, "Of course, I told him that. He shouldn't have done." Right, that sort of, you know, that, you know, it's a joke which, you know, sort of sets up the moral tension in the law. It's really not satisfying. You understand it is not satisfying to say he shouldn't have done. Now, so if we want another way out, right, if you want to find somebody who says no, it's because they're human beings, and we hold that, you know, that we hold that, you know, that human life is the ultimate value of Judaism, etc., etc., except for Avodah Zarah, etc. Right, but we like to say that, right, about Shabbat. So here Meiri says, in terms of pikuach nefesh, saving lives, we don't follow the majority. Right, as for example, you have a courtyard which has both Jews and Ovdei Elilim in it. I would point out that this, here we're talking about civil law discrimination again, so we shouldn't say Ovdei Elilim, we should say Gerim B'drechei Adam. But here he doesn't mention Gerim B'drechei Adam, he only mentions Ovdei Elilim. Right? So if we're dealing with saving people on Shabbat, you have a courtyard which has both Jews and Ovdei Elilim in it, then She'anu Mitzuvim L'Chalal Shabbat Aleihem, these Ovdei Elilim whom we are not required to violate Shabbat for, Ho'il V'Achar, She'en Lehem Shum Dat. Because they have no legal religion. So here is, like, this is why Meiri is such a great source for those of us, you know, Orthodox Jews of universalist leanings. Because here Meiri says, look, in fact, anybody who had, right, in fact, the ones who aren't these, you know, these evil idolaters, you have an obligation to save them on Shabbat even though they're not Jewish. Right? Now the problem is here again, Meir is the only one who says it. And if you want to take this as a basis for Pesach, right, then do you also have to follow his position about twins who convert? Now no one has ever considered following that position. And in my knowledge, there isn't a single trace in halakha. Again, I don't want to make absolute statements because I don't know all of halakha. And you know, my teachers before the Bar Ilan came out, who knew vastly more than me, have often tripped up by making such statements because now I have a computer and I can check this. So I don't want to fall into the same trap. But is it, from a halakhic perspective, is it inconsistent? If Meiri believed that his position, right, his position about the difference between Jews and Gentiles, right, extends, right, applies in all these cases, so can we rule like him in terms of Shabbat and not rule like him in terms of paternity?
Be careful, because this ruling is not which one this was. This is even the real only Avodah Zarah, who we would count as.
No.
He's talking about a question of a chatzer, which is.
No. So he says. This is just an introduction. He says, right, how do we know that you don't follow majority? Because if you have a courtyard which has one Jew and nine of the Eliyim, you have to save them all because we care about the one Jew. And he says, but by the way, this whole case only applies, right, where you're dealing with Ovdei Elilim, who you don't have an obligation to save, because they have no das. But of course, people who have a das, even though they're not Jewish, you would have an obligation to save. That's the implication. Right? That's right. That, I just didn't give you the whole count, but that's the whole quote. Now, I should point out one other thing. Whenever Meiri makes these radical claims, he only makes them by implication. Right? For example, Ovdei Elilim, right, whom one is not obligated to save because they have no doubts. Right? This is the law regarding, right, in terms of paternity, regarding people who have no doubts. Right? When he makes the non-radical claims, he says, but with regard to those who have doubts, when he makes the radical claims, he leaves out the but. Right? He just does the implication. Pretty consistently. So you have to wonder again. Now, does this mean that he really believes these things but he can't get away with it? So he's just seeding the tradition, hoping that somebody will eventually come along and paskin like it? Is he cluing you in that this is really just apologetic and don't believe any of the other places I said it either? I don't know. It's tough to imagine. He says it so many times. And yet at the same time, I would say there's a pattern that, to me, again, I have to show you all the cases, that the more radical he gets halakhically, the less likely he is to spell out the implication. So I'm interested, to see if that pattern really holds up. That would be interesting to me. There's a question?
Did you define das yet?
No.
Okay. Are we going to?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Okay, the last thing I wanted to present is hit, and this is Meiri's whole discussion about wine touched by non-Jews. Probably most of you are aware that wine which has actually been used by non-Jews as a libation is biblically, you can't get any benefits from. Wine which has been touched by a certain set of non-Jews is presumed to have been used for libations and therefore one cannot derive benefit from. Wine which has been touched by non-Jews, even though we know they didn't use it for libations, right, cannot be drunk, but there's no prohibition against deriving benefit from. That's the way we have halakha now. All right, in the Middle Ages, there was still a controversy about what exactly the boundaries were. And here he puts all these positions about whom you can leave alone with wine, right, whose wine forbids drinking, whose wine forbids touching, and all that. In this, right, repeatedly, he talks about, let's take a look, first of all, he mentions the category of ger toshav, okay, and this is where Rabbi Shatz mentioned earlier, right, here we get to, right? A ger toshav may be left alone with wine in our domain, okay, even in a city that's majority Gentile, and we're not worried that ger toshav is going to touch the wine, we don't even mind if he, because why would he touch the wine? He's not going to steal. And he's not going to worship Avodah Zarah. So why would he pour the wine? All right, so ger toshav, we can leave alone with our wine without any difficulty, as long as he's in our house. But if he's in his house, so he might let another Gentile who is not a ger toshav touch the wine. Okay, so the rule regarding a ger toshav is that you can leave him alone in your house with the wine, but you can't leave wine in his house. Okay. Now, what's the definition of the ger toshav for these purposes? Right, is it a ger toshav, as we're waiting for? Right, so kol shekibel alav shul avod avodah zarah. A ger toshav is anybody who accepts the prohibition against avodah zarah.
Okay, good. You don't even need the other six commandments, apparently. You just need to have a dozer.
The Rambam goes a lot further than
that. I know. Okay. Right. It says, B'chachmei Sfarah hiskinu, but the Sephardic rabbis agreed, She'ach he'kula, all of them, She'ach ishmaelim einam ovdim avodah zarah, that even Ishmaelites are not ovdei avodah zarah, and you can leave them with wine in your house, just you don't put the wine in there. Aval shar amamin, but all the other nations, even though we say about them it's just their custom, their hands, nonetheless, minaschim heim, they make libations.
Nowadays Ishmaelim don't drink wine anyway.
Nowadays Ishmaelim don't drink wine at all. That's true. Right? Yeah, not Islam prohibits. Islam prohibits one. Yeah, but whether it actually this is actually carried out or not is a much
different thing on that Islam.
A much different question.
Is it the
one
grape products or is it like the like,
I don't know. I get the impression that this is that this has worked about as well as prohibition did in America, historically. The parties at which all the Jewish poets and the Arabic poets are together. There's a lot of wine there.
It's like that story. Right?
Yes, the
Rubaiyat, right?
In the Middle
right?
Ages, yeah. In Muslim countries, they weren't supposed to, but they did.
Yes, right. So I wouldn't say that Muslims, right, that you can leave Muslims alone in their house because they don't drink wine. That seems to have been a push. That seems to have been deeply that would have been a deeply unwise principle, from what we can tell, in high Muslim culture. Okay. Nonetheless, these other nations all bring libations, and even these, meaning Ger Toshav, we still have the prohibition because of we're afraid of intermarriage. Now we just look at the language, right? He says Ger Toshav is anybody who accepts upon themselves not to worship Avodah Zarah, and the Spanish rabbis say that includes Muslims, but all the other nations are different. Now we know the Spanish rabbis is Maimonides. Maimonides says explicitly that Christians are of the Avodah Zarah. Not a peep. Familiar. And it goes on again. Right? Whole discussion about whether this is true of Ishmaelites, right, of Ishmaelites or not. And then he goes on to tell you later on, he says, the great commentators, Yoliam and Forshim, we talk about the Miri, has this thing, he doesn't identify anybody by name, he only identifies people by nickname. Which is why I think that Talmud student of the Rashba may be his student because he's the only other that is the only other medieval commentator I know of who identifies people by nickname as opposed to by name. At the beginning of his work, Miria tells you who each of these people are that he's going to refer to in his commentary. So he says that right. So the Gedolei HaMechaberim and the Gaonim agreed regarding Ishmaelites. That their touch, right? That their touch is assumes that there's no obligation to libate, and they make different claims by a ger toshav. Then at the end he says, right? Even though for this, right, the fourth paragraph on the page, even though for this purpose anyone, right, who's known not to worship Avodah Zarah is called a ger toshav. In terms of the purpose of keeping someone alive, you're not called a ger toshav unless you formally accept the seven commandments in front of a rabbinic court. Okay. So now, where did all the Christians go? It has vanished. He has got lots of opportunities to say, but our nation, Sheinam Hagdirim Midrachei Adatot, lots and lots of opportunities. Mitzvah L'Hachiyoto, he just said we have to save them on Shabbos. So hard to know what Miri is saying with any degree of.
Well, he just here explicitly saying, don't have to save them on Shabbos.
Right. So what's going on?
Despite what the indication you we inferred from the previous text.
So it's very, very difficult. This is the opportunity, right? This is the opportunity. He gets so many opportunities to do it, and he just doesn't say. So, in terms of so this is what I think is the is Professor Henkin is Rabbi Henkin's really compelling argument. Just some silence. There's so many places that Miri has the opportunity to just tell us Christians are not of the Avodah Zarah. He says, right, the Sephardic rabbis write that Muslims are not of the Avodah Zarah. He never says it about Christians. He has so many opportunities. It's suspicious. It's at least suspicious. Now pulling this all together, actually the last thing is, now we hold the halacha, a very strange halacha, we hold that Christians are
right, do not make wine yayin neseh. Right, they only make wine stami and amrit, because we say that Christians do not make libations. Now, this is a weird, weird halakha, because difficult to imagine that the, right, that the wine of the Eucharist is not a class, right? I know it's not a libation. So it's not a libation, but is it? Could you ask for more of a, if you think Christianity is about Dazara, could you ask for more intense participation in ritual? Right, than to make something part, right, and to make something part, right, into the flesh of your God, the blood of your God? It's a wild, wild thing to me. Wild, wild thing. You know, Ramah says this, and it's got, you know, to me, it's like one of the all-time great stretches in halakha to make this, right, to make this claim. It seems to me the simplest way of understanding Miri here is, as Rav Henkin suggests, that he doesn't think Trinitarianism is necessarily Avodah Zarah, but he thinks that certain practices are, and he won't say that Christians are not of the Avodah Zarah for this purposes, because in fact they use the wine of the Eucharist, right, in idolatrous ritual. Right, and so while there are other purposes which he's willing to say this about, he's willing to say that that Christians don't fall into these categories, he's not going to say that Christianity doesn't involve it. And in this particular case, right, in the same way, if you ask, you know, can you leave a Christian alone in your house with a statue of Jesus and not worry about him worshiping Avodah Zarah? No, right, he's going to bow down to it. Right, that's a real risk.
Can't really have,
but if you're worried about him taking an oath, well, that's a theological question.
How do you have a statue there?
Right?
It's on loan. Statue's on loan.
Yeah, statue shouldn't be there anyway. Okay. Right. It's a suffix statue because you want to. I mean, I actually got a Shiloh from Israel a couple of months ago. Somebody who bought a jacket and discovered after, you know, looked at one of the decorations of the jacket and said, "Wow, that's a Buddha." Right. So they sent me a photo of, you know, this picture, right, to say, you know, am I allowed to keep this jacket or not? So right, so I have a computer now, so can I leave somebody alone right, in the room, right, with this image?
Oh,
right.
Was it a Buddha?
The jacket was returnable. And I strongly suggested that they return the jacket. You know, it was like one of these things that wasn't, you know, it was designed to be sort of like a Buddha. You know, it was supposed to be designed to remind you of the image, but perhaps not to offend religious sensibilities over much. That, you know, they altered some of the features. Okay. So the first question. So we have to deal with in terms of paskim like the Miri. So on the one hand, we really want a paskim like the Miri because he lets us save Gentiles on Shabbos, especially the Gentiles around us. On the other hand, we're not willing to say that Gentile twin converts are related. So is it honest? Even if we're ideologically motivated, how, right, does that let us pick and choose? Secondly, right, does Miri really believe this? Again, because we're not, right, not only are we not willing to paskin like it about twins, it's not that we believe he meant it by twins. But there are more deeper issues in terms of paskin like Miri. And here I have to say that there's this anti-religious website which published probably the best article so far. Professor Habertal is really good, but this is really, really good. obviously formerly Orthodox doctor, I think, named David Goldstein, wrote this whole article on Miri, and the point was to show that you can't defend Orthodox Judaism on the grounds of Miri. Along the way, he examines what Miri does really well. It's a really good article on Miri. He did the manuscript work about the different versions of that tractate. You know, a really good piece, I have to say. You have to worry whether it's Sifrei Minim or not, but right. So, but happily, it's not a website, so it's not such a. There's nothing real. what he says is, and I didn't bring the actual quote. What he says is, you know what, Miri doesn't help you so much. Because when it comes down to it, what does Miri really say? And Miri says that people who have a das, and agdirim b'drachei hadas, they're okay. Now what's a das? Right, so a das is, Professor Halbertal says, I think he's absolutely right, and Miri in various places defines this. A das is a legal religion. It's a religion which enforces moral law. Miri is very clear, he doesn't believe that atheists can be moral. He doesn't say people who behave properly. Right? He says people who are gadur bidrachei hadas. Right? They have to be bound by religious law. Now this is a common belief, you know, all debates about, you know, about religion
in America in the 18th century, all about, is it possible to construct a moral society without belief in God? And they really clearly believed not. So yeah, still kind of, all the debates about the founding fathers and all that, right? You know, Jefferson, right? You know, I don't necessarily believe, but it's important for the people to believe because you can't possibly do it, right? So if we take Meire at what he says, Meire gives us no room at all, right, to justify treatment of atheists at all. Probably, Meire gives us no room at all to deal with Protestants, and particularly America. Because America is the one place in which religion has absolutely no legal force. Right? So America is a society which is built on the presumption.
Was there just Catholics? Sorry.
Catholics still have some kind of legal sanctions. You know, they still have a vote,
but it doesn't have any power.
No, but they regard their religion themselves as being, right, they see themselves as bound by law. Now, let's go even further. Right, what does Meire want? He wants a religion that conceives of its obligations as law and then enforces them. And what's his example of things it enforces? Well, it enforces laws about sexuality. Okay? What's his prime example? Homosexuality. Right? So the religion, the kind of people whom Meire thinks we can treat differently are the kind of people who believe that there should be, right, that there should be practical religious punishments for homosexuality.
Where's Meire say this?
So an example, in sort number 15, right, was it 15? There are a number of places he talks about, right, that they don't do toe votes, right? They enforce laws against toe votes, right? And that's, right, toe va is, of course, a, right? So if you look at source number 5, the 6th line in the Hebrew, that was Rabbi Hankins' line, right? In the 5th line, Rabbi says that they keep the boundaries, Elohim, kol aviram, v'chol kiyur yafeh b'nehem. So Hank's claim is Gilead Arayot. So let's take a look at source number. Source line
about Arnona. The bottom of 15 about homosexuality.
Is there a 15 talk about it explicitly?
Yeah, that's a 15 talk.
In the 15, right? The Talmud writes Arnona was not suspected of sexuality since he was a Ger Toshav. Yeah, I think clearly the point of the Gerub Midrashi Adad is that it enforces the boundaries of religion, right? Of the Sheva Mitzvot, right? There's the people who keep the Sheva Mitzvot, and Kal V'chomer, the people who keep the Sheva Mitzvot as a matter of religious law.
This is strongly opposed to the Rambam.
Yes.
Right? It says that strongly Gerd Toshav, if you accept Sheva Mitzvot,
yeah,
as you say so.
Yes, yeah, so the Meire is radically opposed to the Rambam in that he grants legitimacy, right, for certain purposes to extra-Jewish religion. And you can see that in a number of places, where the Rambam, at least not one place, has that striking claim it has to be because it's in our Torah. But if you ask, like, who are the Meire's enemy? It's liberal Protestants, right, who don't have the case code of sexual morality, don't believe in enforcing religion, right? So if you ask me, does passing like the Meire get me where we need to get in America as an ideologue? No. Right, so my answer is that usually the debate is, you know, of course, to get to where we want to get ideologically, you have to pass him like the Meire. The question is, can you pass him like the Meire? And my answer is no. Of course you can pass him like the Meire, but it doesn't get you where you want to get. All right, because what we need is atheists and liberal Protestants, right? And you know, that's what we have in America, you know, and it doesn't get us there at all. So my suggestion actually is, in the end, that what we really need is, right, that there have been several moves, some of which are more convincing than others, to take the broader ethical principles of reciprocity, etc., such as Mishum Eva as a negative principle, and Mipnei Darkei Shalom as a positive principle. Rabbi Walter Wurzberger of blessed memory was the first in contemporary in America to do this, but there are any number of rabbis, Yehuda Unterman and Rav Chaim David Halevi, there are many people who have argued that you have to take Darkei Shalom, Eva, or even unstated principles that are behind those, and say that there's a fundamental principle that you're supposed to treat other human beings in an ultimately moral fashion. We interpret Darkei Shalom not as to keep the peace, but there's a positive obligation to create a productive culture. We treat Mishum Eva not as don't do things that will hate you, but don't do things that will make them deservedly hate you. And Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, the late chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, argued even further that Darkei Shalom is what we do when people have, when treating with people who have lost their right because of their behavior to ordinary moral treatment. So we say, even then, we have obligations to ourselves to treat them that way on certain issues. But obviously, right, if they're the kind of people who deserved it, we would have to do that at a simple Reddit because it's simply right and wrong. And my take is that in the, right, if we really want to get to where we get with real halachic integrity, then Erie is not the way to do it. It's, you know, it's nice to pull out of certain narrow issues, but on the core issue, allowing the debate to be confined to whether we pass on like the Miri or not is a mistake, because we can't really honestly say that the Miri, that what we want to reach is what the Miri says, right? Because we're not interested in only being able to treat Catholics in a particular way. Secondly, we don't really want to be able to say necessarily. I don't want to say that conversion to Christianity is not Yehereg Vel Yavor. Right? I think, you know, I think martyrdom is justified. I don't want to break down the boundaries and say we all worship the same God, so what? I think there are real differences. I think the category of Avodah Zarah is real. And the question is, how do we deal? And there again, I think that Rabbi Henkins and Josh Harrison's formulation is right. How do we deal with a society in which theology does not have immediate moral implications? Right? You can talk about people as having bad theology, or even bad ritual practice without claiming that means they're of poor character. And that, I think, is a real challenge.
Well, for that matter, the poor character without having bad
ritual. No, I understand. That's an old issue. Right? That we know how to deal with. That's an old, at least we know, it is a whole history. But this new phenomenon, right, of, you know, whole cultures that we evaluate positively, morally, overall. Right? We might have debates about certain issues with sexuality, but we think that, you know, basically, they're good people and they really treat us well, right? Even though religiously they have positions, they engage in activities that the Torah calls Avodah Zarah, and we think their theology, right, is at the best confusing, right? I think that the way to do that is not going to be through the Miri. Miri offers a theological opening, because what Miri does offer, which is really helpful, whether or not he says it about Christianity, is the capacity to make that distinction. That you can be a technical violator of Avodah Zarah, right, and not be a horrible person. And that, I think, it's actually more helpful than in Halbertal's thesis. Because Halbertal's thesis, he says, they're not of the Avodah Zarah. Right? And the point is, no, they are of the Avodah Zarah, and it doesn't matter. Right? Their Miri is really helpful. But to use his authority is not really fair, because he only believed this about people who have certain theological beliefs and cultural claims which aren't true.
The obvious move at that point is to say that the Meiri could only conceive of moral authorities flowing from religion. He had no other example to deal with. No one could come to him with a shiloh, or he could not think of the case of people with similar moral behavior as to what he was expecting who were not guided by religion.
So now we can claim
it's a question of what the essence of the Meiri's requirement is.
So we can distill it and say that here he made a wrong factual assumption, but really he would come to the same conclusion. All right, we could do that.
Yeah, it's not far-fetched.
It's not far-fetched, you just don't know. And if you want to use his authority, and everything, we're taking a minority position.
To take
an extension of a minority position that is a push. I think we're better off. This is what he does, Mike. I think we're better off claiming that we're a mainstream position. Right? This is what, right, that, you know, that Darkei Shalom Ibneiva and, you know, and meta principles such as Kodah Briyot, right, have always been there, and they need to be understood in this way. I think that's the more productive end. That would be my summary. I'm not convinced by the reading of Miri that way. I'm not convinced Miri meant it as far as he says it. I'm convinced that Miri isn't saying what we want him to say anyway. So we could pass it like him. It's not really honest to say that we're doing the things we do because we hold like Miri. And we should go back to working on developing a thesis that comes out of broader principles in halakha, rather than pegging it on one particular position, fun as that position is, and useful as that position may be in particular narrow cases. All right, thank you once again for your attention.
Thank you.
I hope we'll have the opportunity to learn together again.
We hope so.